got my bags packed and on a roll. I'm heading out there and I'm ready to go. I'm looking real good in my passport photo.
Amateur Traveler, episode 658. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about small towns and large bluffs, B&Bs and state parks, a summer powwow, and the world's largest boot. As we go to the northern Mississippi Valley. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Let's talk about the Mississippi River Valley.
I'd like to welcome to the show Dean Klinkenberg from MississippiValleyTraveler.com. And oddly enough, Dean has come to talk to us about the Mississippi Valley. Dean, welcome to the show.
Well, hi, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for giving me a chance to come and extol the virtues of travel along the Mississippi.
Now, you pitched me travel along the Mississippi, and I came back with, well, what's the best one-week itinerary? And you're not taking me where I think of when I think of the Mississippi. I think of that long river, but I think of that real wide part near the bottom of the river, near the southern part of the river, and that's not where you're taking me this week.
That's true. It's kind of hard to pick one particular stretch along a 2,000-mile river to highlight, but I think the lower part of the river people have some familiarity with already because of New Orleans and Memphis and Vicksburg. I think it's time to talk a little bit more about the upper half of the river and give people some good ideas on what they can do to get to know that part of the river as well.
Excellent. Although I do like that southern part of the river with just those very places you named, New Orleans and Memphis and Vicksburg, all wonderful places. And we have talked about them on the show and we'll talk about them again. But what itinerary are you recommending?
So I'm recommending about a 200-mile loop drive that you could do from starting from Minneapolis or St. Paul, going down to about La Crosse, Wisconsin, and then you go down the Minnesota side for part of it, and then you come up the Wisconsin side of the river for the other part of it. So it's about 200 miles, but we're going to figure out a way to do it over a week.
All right. 200 miles in a week does not sound that hard. I've been known to do 350 miles in one way in a weekend, so I think we could do it.
Great.
Where are you starting us? You said Minneapolis, St. Paul, and then where to?
So I'm making a couple of assumptions here. So I think it's easiest probably to do this route. Like if you're coming from far away, you can fly into the airport in Minneapolis and rent a car from there and do this route very easily. You could also take Amtrak to St. Paul and then rent a car from there to do this route. But we're focusing on a driving tour. We're going to start at the northern end of this route, and we're going to spend our first day or two in Red Wing, Minnesota, which is only about 45 minutes to an hour's drive from the Minneapolis airport. So I kind of have this outlined as a trip where you'd start probably from the Twin Cities. You'd spend a night or two in Red Wing, Minnesota. Then we're going to go downriver a little bit to Reed's Landing or Wabasha, Minnesota, then down to Winona. And then we're going to cross the river to La Crosse, Wisconsin, and spend a couple nights there. And then we're going to work our way back north and spend our last night probably in Fountain City. It was a little hard to like figure out where the best place to be for that last night would be, but I think Fountain City will be a fine choice.
Excellent. And now you started us in Red Wing, and as I understand, not very far from the Minneapolis-St. Paul airport.
That's right. It's a popular day trip, I think, for a lot of Twin Cities residents, but there's quite a lot to do there. And I'm kind of allotting two nights. I'm just assuming that if you flew in or you're coming from somewhere else, you may only have part of a first day. So you may as well stay for two nights and explore some of the sites. And Red Wing is a very attractive old river town. The downtown area has had a lot of renovation in the last decade or two, and it's sparkling with red brick storefronts and historic lighting, and it's really close to the river. So it's an easy place to walk around, and there's quite a bit to do in the immediate area. So.
Okay. And before we get into the things to do in Red Wing, we just drove our first stretch of the river here, and I think it's not the river I'm picturing, first of all, right? It's not that big, wide river in the south. What is it like in that first stretch between St. Paul and Red Wing?
What I like about this part of the river is it is fairly wide, wider than you might think, but it's framed by limestone bluffs that rise anywhere from 300 to 500 feet above the river. So you have this gorgeous river valley with these yellowish limestone bluffs on either side. And then the river itself has a braided channel in most places. So there are lots of side channels and islands, and there's floodplain forests that are thick with vegetation. It's a very scenic area, and there are lots of places where you can take it in from the river level, or you can go up high on top of the bluffs and get expansive views looking up and down the river itself. It's a little wider than you might think because the river's been engineered with a series of locks and dams to create a deep enough channel for bulk transportation.
Got it.
So that is one feature of this part of the river that makes it a little wider than it might look otherwise, but it's still a gorgeous scenery.
Well, and are we going to drive straight to Red Wing, or are there places, you say there are a number of places I can stop. Where would you recommend I stop?
I think we're going to start in Red Wing.
Okay.
So, I mean, there are a couple of towns along the way that are interesting in their own right, and if you have a lot of extra time, you could stop in Hastings, Minnesota, or Prescott, Wisconsin. I think we'll just probably plan on, after we get our bags from the terminal at the airport, we'll just drive on to Red Wing and stretch our legs and get going. So,
okay. I would love to hear about the wonders of Red Wing.
So, as I mentioned, it's a scenic old river town. And I think one of the themes you're going to hear as we talk about this itinerary throughout is outdoors is really one of the main attractions for visiting this part of the river. You can design pretty much any kind of a trip that you want, from, you know, a luxury experience where you're pampered most of the time to roughing it outdoors and primitive camping. This leans a little bit more toward the easier, take it easy kind of trip where you're going to be able to stretch your legs, do some hiking, get outside, and then you're still going to have a chance to sample some good food and some museums and that sort of thing. So in Red Wing, one of the landmarks is a bluff remnant called Barn Bluff.
Okay.
It's an old bluff that the river over time has had a couple different channels. So it at one time would have been an island, and now it's just this giant bluff that stands by itself in something of a shape of a barn. There are hiking trails all over the bluff. You can hike up to the top of it and get really great views of Red Wing and the Mississippi Valley from there. I think that should be on high in anybody's list if the weather cooperates. There are places that you can do bike tours. There's a paved multi-use trail along the Cannon River, which is a tributary of the Mississippi, and you can bike, I think it's 30 or 40 miles along that from Cannon Valley down toward Red Wing, and that's a really nice ride, mostly flat. There are companies that, a small couple of companies that offer boat tours. In Red Wing in particular, there are a couple of small operators that focus on tours that take you into the backwater areas, mostly where you can see more wildlife. Those are really good tours to take. And Red Wing's got a couple of small museums, I think, that help you get a sense of what the community's history is like. One of them isn't so much related to the city itself, but there's a military veteran who retired and had an incredible collection of artifacts that he collected during his 30 years. So he opened this small museum called the Oliveo Military Museum. It's kind of an interesting tour through this one man's tour of duty. And the Goodhue County History Center is a great place just to get kind of that general overview of the region's history from the Native Americans who lived there thousands of years before Europeans showed up, all the way through the manufacturing years and to today. So it does a good job of covering the area's history. If you need to do something inside, there's early 1900s theater, the Sheldon Theater, that hosts a lot of live shows and bands, and it's a good place to get yourself some entertainment. And if you're looking for that perfect photo for Instagram, Red Wing is the home of the Red Wing Boot Company, which you've probably heard of.
That is probably the only thing I did know about Red Wing.
See, now you know a few more. But a few years ago, the Red Wing Boot Company, their workers built the world's largest boot.
Okay.
Which is a great for a photo op. It's about 16 feet tall. That's pretty tall. It's a size 638.5D. I don't know if you know anybody who could use a boot in that size.
I'm slightly smaller than that and a little narrower.
So it's just kind of a fun way to show off the town's history, the manufacturing history. But it's a legitimate boot made just like they would make everything else, just a lot bigger.
I love that they say it weighs over a ton and it's too big for the Statue of Liberty to wear. I'm not sure that the boot would go with the Statue of Liberty's gown anyway, but good to know.
Yeah, they might clash.
They might clash.
On the other hand, Paul Bunyan might find it pretty useful.
That was where I thought they would go, but apparently not.
Yeah. So those are just a few of the things. One of the other things that I like about this part of the river is there's some really interesting festivals. Depending upon the time of year you're traveling through, just north of Red Wing, but I think this is technically part of the city of Red Wing now. There's an area called Prairie Island that's home to the Prairie Island Indian community.
Okay.
It's a small community of Dakota Indians who moved back to that part of Minnesota in the late 19th century. And they're, I believe, they're a federally recognized tribe on this reservation. So they have a really big casino and they do some river tours. But the other thing that they do is in summer, in July, they have a big powwow that draws a good crowd. And so if you happen to be in the Red Wing area in July, you look for when the powwow is happening. And that would be a good event to go up and experience.
Now, you say move back to this area. My understanding is that the Dakota would have been from here originally, but then later on got pushed out to a reservation further west.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a long and complicated story, but the basics of it are they were confined to reservation lands along the Minnesota River mostly until about 1862 when a major conflict broke out. As a result of that war, that conflict, most of the Dakota were kicked out of Minnesota.
Okay.
Most of them were resettled on reservation lands in Nebraska and the Dakotas. But some of them were not particularly happy with the area where they were relocated to, and they came back to Minnesota to Prairie Island, which had long been an area where Dakota lived. And they bought land, and they made a new home, and eventually they got federal recognition for that reservation.
Interesting, because I was seeing that Red Wing itself gets its name not from the boot. The boot gets its name from the city, and they get their name from a Dakota Sioux chief, Red Wing.
That's right.
Who was not an ally of the U.S., but an ally of the British during the War of 1812. So kind of interesting that a town in the U.S. is named after him. But
yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the Dakota Indians, a lot of the Indians who were allied with the British at one time eventually like switched their loyalties when they figured out the U.S. was going to be a better trading partner and the British weren't going to be around very much. So,
right.
Yeah.
Excellent. So Dakota Sioux Festival there. That was the last thing that you named before we went off on that tangent.
Yeah. So that's the Prairie Island Indian community. So Red Wing's got a couple of interesting places to stay. I mean, it's a town that's got a lot of B&Bs to choose from. If you're a bed and breakfast kind of person, there are four or five in the immediate area, and any of them would be a good place to stay. I also like the St. James Hotel, which is a historic 19th century riverfront hotel. That would probably be my first choice as a place to stay. And it also happens to have, I think, three different restaurants, including one that's got a nice outdoor patio. If the weather's nice, you can sit out and watch the river float by as you have a meal. And most of the rooms have some kind of river theme or river name, so it's appropriate.
All right.
After this, so we're going to move on downriver. If we were going to drive straight through, our next stop in the Wabasha Reed's Landing area would only take about half hour, 45 minutes tops to get there from Red Wing. But, of course, we're going to take our time because there are plenty to see along the way. Just south of Red Wing, there's an old community called Frontenac. In the 19th century, it was a popular resort community. The buildings from that era are still around, although they're all privately owned now. So you can't tour the inside of them, but you can drive by and take a look. The town also has a really interesting old church. It's a Christ Episcopal Church that was built just after the Civil War. And other than getting wired for electricity and getting an HVAC system hooked up, the church looks pretty much the way it did when it was built 150 years ago. So I think that's kind of a unique experience to be able to see the church back basically as it originally looked. Also nearby Frontenac, there's a state park. If you're coming in a camper or with a tent and you need a place to pitch your tent for the night, Frontenac State Park has a number of campsites, and then they've got a couple of good hiking trails atop the bluff and down in the floodplain with some really nice views looking over the river valley. You'll hear me mention overlooks and great views several times. It's one of the themes. Maybe you should put together a checklist to collect overlooks as you go through this. The next stop from there, as you're heading down toward Wabasha, is the community of Lake City, which is very much a resort town, I think. I mean, there is an actual functioning city there, but in the summertime, especially on the weekends, the population will triple or more as people primarily from the Twin Cities will come down for a weekend to hang out on the lake. So this part of the river, from Red Wing south to about Wabasha, there's a widening of the river called Lake Pepin. And I think this came up in your Twin Cities episode.
Uh-huh.
I think your guest mentioned it then. It's a natural lake in the main channel of the river. The Chippewa River on the southern end of this carries more sediment than the Mississippi can discharge. So over time, it's built up a natural dam and slowed the flow and created this wide lake in the middle of the main channel. So it's really spectacular view. You have water that goes almost from bluff to bluff, you know, up to about 3 miles. It's a popular place for sailboating and fishing and hanging out on the beach and eating good food and basically just taking it easy. So Lake City is one of the communities that caters to that experience, and they have a lot of condos and lodging and other options for people who want to come and just spend a weekend there hanging out. So it's a pretty place to stop. And if you have time while you're there, you could go on a sailboat tour or a hang gliding tour to see the lake from a very different perspective. One of the fun little trivial note about Lake City is out there on Lake Pepin is where water skiing was invented.
Oh.
People probably don't think of Minnesota as.
Did not know, yeah.
1922, Ralph Samuelson took a couple of wooden snow skis, basically, and adapted them for the water and became, as far as we know, the first person to get on these slabs of wood behind a boat going really fast. So,
I guess it only makes sense with the number of lakes in Minnesota, just the law of averages, if nothing else, would say that water skiing was invented in Minnesota. But I did not know that.
Yes. How about that? So we're going to spend the night down in the area of Reed's Landing and Wabasha, and I'm kind of hedging my bets here a little bit, too, with where you might want to spend the night. Reed's Landing is a tiny community, but it has a spectacular bed and breakfast, the American Eagle Bluff bed and breakfast that is on top of a bluff with amazing views looking out over the confluence of the Chippewa River and the Mississippi. They're a fairly small place, so you may not be able to get a room there, in which case you'll probably go on into Wabasha. But if you can get a room at the American Eagle B&B, that's the place you should spend the night. Reed's Landing was a boom town in the 19th century when logging was the major industry in this part of the country. And they had kind of an assembly facility nearby where all these logs would come down the Chippewa River and other places, and they'd assemble them into giant rafts and then push them downriver to mills to be processed. I think that one time there may have been more bars than people in Reed's Landing, which might still be the case. But it's an interesting town with an interesting history. And they have an old schoolhouse they've converted into their county historical museum, which is worth the time to go through. You'll see a lot of photos and stories about the logging era. But also they have this big old barn full of farm implements that go back at least 100 years or more. So it's kind of fun to walk through those and imagine yourself pushing some of those old plows or whatever, trying to make a living. We're going to spend the night here. And so Wabasha also has a bed and breakfast called Turning Waters. Wabasha is an interesting little town in its own right also. There are a couple different times of year that would be really good to go here. Like if you're looking for a good winter escape, I mean, is an escaping to winter, Wabasha has a festival in February called the Grumpy Old Men Festival.
All right, I'm nearly qualified for that.
I'm getting closer. Do you remember the movies, the Grumpy Old Men movies?
Yeah, sure.
So the guy who wrote those was a Minnesota native, and I think the stories were inspired by, I think, his grandfather who lived in the Wabasha area. So I don't know if like Jack Lemmon or Walter Matthau was the person who played his grandfather, or maybe there was some inspiration that went beyond that. What I love is that the town of Wabasha decided to embrace this, and after the movies came out, they decided to have their own festival in February. The highlight is the ice fishing contest. Okay. Which is not really a spectator sport, so be prepared to participate.
Okay.
But they also have a hot dish buffet lunch at one of the churches, so that's worth going to.
Now, when you talk about ice fishing, this isn't just a sport. This is a culture in this area, and it is one that is a remote and distant culture from where I grew up. So tell me how I go about ice fishing.
Well, I think the first step is dress warm.
Sure.
In layers.
I think that came from the name. Okay.
Yep. There are different ways to do this. Like there's sometimes people just go out, you need an auger. You need a way to cut a hole in the ice.
Right.
You know, there are power augers and there are manual ones. Depends on how much work you want to put into it. And you just like poke a hole through the ice. And sometimes people just bring a bucket and they use that as their chair and they drop their line through that hole.
And you say, just poke a hole. As I recall from Boy Scouts, I want to be at least have 4 inches of ice before I'm out there, preferably a foot. So poke a hole itself is a little more complicated than that. That auger is going to take a little while.
Yeah, it's going to take some work because the ice is pretty thick.
Yeah.
Especially by February. You know, it's been cold a long time, so the ice is pretty thick.
And this is ice on the Mississippi, or this is ice on one of the tributaries?
They usually do this in the harbor, which is just off the Mississippi.
Okay.
In their little marina. But people go out in the backwaters and ice fish there. You'll see houses, little structures out on the ice.
I understand. In fact, I'd say that it was the quintessential way to go ice fishing, right, is to have your ice fishing house.
Yeah, that's very like Minnesotan or Wisconsin. You got to have that ice fishing house. It's a nice way to get away for a couple days or a couple hours. And
it feels like fishing may not always be involved.
Catching fish isn't always the most important part of the experience. That's true. Just being there is. Plus, you get a certain street credibility for sitting out on the ice for a few hours. So,
okay.
So, yeah, so you can do that in Wabasha. You can do that in a lot of places along the Mississippi in the wintertime. You can go ice fishing. And in some of the backwater areas, the ice gets thick enough, people will drive their cars out over the ice to get to where their ice fishing houses are.
Sure.
But check with the locals before you do that. Don't just do it.
Garrison Keillor's old monologues, he used to talk about whether the truck had fallen into the ice yet, and that's the sign of the spring, is the first truck falling into the ice out of there on Lake Wobegon, which is fictional but based on real things in that culture of the region.
It's probably a safe bet that a truck falling through the ice happens somewhere at least once every spring, so
right.
I would think. So yeah, Wabasha also is home to the National Eagle Center.
Interesting. So okay.
All things bald eagle. It's really a fantastic museum, and it's right on the river. It's because of its location, the river doesn't usually freeze right mm-hmm. in that section by Wabasha. So it's an area where bald eagles tend to congregate in big numbers in wintertime, but there's a population there all year.
And they're congregating there because they're eating the fish from the river, and they don't have an auger.
That's true. They don't have an all auger, right. And they're not at risk of losing their truck when the ice melts. As the river starts to freeze up, bald eagles migrate south, and they tend to congregate in big numbers around open water on the Mississippi.
Okay.
So this is one around Wabasha, usually on the downriver end of the locks and dams. There's open water, so there'll be a lot of eagles there as well. And at the National Eagle Center, they have a couple of rescue birds. You can't touch them, but you can get very close to them. So you get a real sense for how big those birds really are. It's a great experience.
Okay.
So the other thing in Wabasha, so this is getting to be a really busy day and a half. There's a company called Broken Paddle Guiding Company that takes people on kayak tours through the backwaters and then down part of the main channel. So I highly recommend you make time to do that. That's a great way to see the backwaters up close. You'll see some wildlife. There's no guarantee you're going to see a lot, but you know, when I went with them, we saw bald eagles and hawks and an otter. There's always wildlife around there. And in a kayak, you're pretty quiet, so you can sneak up on the animals and have a better chance of seeing them.
And when you say the backwaters, are we going over? I know there's a state natural area to the north of there, as well as another reserve. Are we heading up that direction, or where are you kayaking?
Yeah, they crossed the bridge to the Wisconsin side, and there's a whole complex of backwaters and islands at the Chippewa River Delta where it meets the Mississippi, and that's the area that they paddle through.
Got it. Okay.
It's awesome.
That doesn't sound like that's going to be the same time of year that I'm going to be doing the ice fishing. So we're just started talking about two different trips here. One that we're doing in the winter. You said February was the Grumpy Old Men Festival. That sounds like a good time for ice fishing. When would you recommend if we wanted to do the kayaking instead of the ice fishing?
Midsummer is probably best.
Okay.
From June until the river freezes, actually, until October, November, in that range. Even fall is a great time to paddle back there, and then you don't have fewer bugs in the fall.
Okay.
But usually people will do that in the middle of the summer.
Okay.
If you don't get a chance to go to the Grumpy Old Men Festival, if you're there in the summertime, there's a restaurant called Slippery's that is inspired by the Slippery's from the movie.
Okay. So, I don't think I've ever seen the movies, so
now you're going to have to.
Maybe.
Watch the first one at least. Okay. It's pretty fun. It's funny. So yeah, you can hang out at Slippery's and watch the river go by and be as grumpy as you want. So.
And is there a particular thing I would want to order that would be in keeping with the tradition of the grumpy old men?
Well, I suppose if you're going to try to eat what the characters would eat, you'd see what the walleye plate is like.
Okay.
But they have a full menu, so you can get just about anything you want there.
Okay.
And if you're looking for, you know, I forgot to mention this in Red Wing, but you know, a lot of the towns now have small craft breweries also.
Okay.
And back up in Reed's Landing, if you're lucky to spend the night at the American Eagle Bluff Bed and Breakfast, there's a place called the Reed's Landing Brewing Company. They have four or five of their own beers that they make that are available at that little restaurant. And there are other places we'll talk about where you can get some good craft beer experience too. Hmm. So, yeah, so there'll be lots of opportunities to sample craft beer at some other places.
Okay.
We probably better start making our way south. This is getting to be a busy trip already. So we're going to drive down to Winona now, which, again, is, if you drove straight through, would only be about a 45-minute drive or so from Wabasha. And we're going to make a couple of quick stops on the way. Just outside of Wabasha is the town of Kellogg. It's the home of Lark Toys.
I do not know Lark Toys.
You don't really have to, but it's kind of a bit of a playground. They have a big visitor center where you can see all the different toys that they make. They have a fun carousel inside and ice cream shop. If you're traveling with kids in particular, it's a good place to stop and let them run around for a little while. And in town, in Kellogg itself, there's a restaurant called the Town and Country Cafe. That's one of my favorite spots to get a piece of pie.
Okay.
I kind of think, like, when it comes to pie, the Midwest is second to none. And this little restaurant, the last time I was there, they had a dozen different kinds of pie available. So they don't fool around.
Well, and I'm sure that those are fighting words, but there are people rising up out of their chairs, at least in the South or other places in the U.S. But I think it's a defensible position. I've had some good pie in the Midwest.
Yeah, I've had some good pie in a lot of places, and I've never had pie as consistently good as what I get in the Midwest, but people can challenge me on it.
In this region, is there a particular pie? It's going to depend on the season, obviously, but what's the best pie experience I'm going to have?
Well, that one's a little harder to nail down. I like to try some of the more unusual combinations. I think some of the pies are, some of the flavor profiles are influenced by some old world recipes.
Okay.
So what was that called? It was a sour cream and raisin pie I've had in a couple of restaurants that was really good. Obviously, you can find apple in your standard fruit pies, but you tend to see more variations. I like rhubarb pies and its variations, like strawberry rhubarb is really good. So you tend to get some pies that have a little more local flavor, but also influenced by recipes I think they brought from the old country.
Okay, and the old country here being predominantly German and Scandinavia is what I'm picturing.
You're right on.
Okay.
We're going to make maybe one other stop as we head down to Winona. There's another small community called Minnieska.
Okay.
At the north end of town, right next to each other, are two wood carvers, two very accomplished wood carvers. They're kind of hit or miss when they're open, so it's worth like driving by and seeing if there's a truck parked out front, and if so, you're welcome to pop in and say hi and take a look at the work that they create. One of them in particular, Longseth Norsk Wood Carving, is quite a river character. He's been there a long time, and I think it was, I don't remember if it was his grandfather or great-grandfather, but one of his ancestors may still have this distinction, but he at one time had the Guinness record for the longest beard.
Okay.
And he's got a picture hanging there in his shop, and he's very happy to talk about that world record. So that's worth the stop, just for the stories. And just outside of town, there's a small state park, John Latch State Park, that really is just an overlook. So you park at river level, and then you have to hike up to the top of the bluff. It's about 400 to 500 feet higher than from the parking lot. So it's a little bit of work to get up there. But again, you've got great views when you're there, and it helps you work off some of the calories from that pie you just ate.
And you mentioned a state park. I haven't been mentioning every state park I have seen on the map that we have driven by, but I would be surprised if we haven't driven by 20 to 50 different state parks on the way down. I mean, a lot of the land here on both sides of the river, on islands in the middle of the river, are various state parks or wildlife refuges. So it would take quite a lot of time to talk about all the different benefits of all of them.
Absolutely. We don't have that much time,
yeah.
So we're not going to do that. I will say, like, the other thing that is worth mentioning is that the river from Wabasha, Minnesota, south to the Quad Cities, much of that is part of the Upper Mississippi River Fish and Wildlife Refuge. So
okay.
That's part of the reason there's so much protected land, is that it's all federal refuge.
Pardon the ignorant question, but which are the Quad Cities?
Oh, sorry. That's like Davenport, Bettendorf, Iowa, Rock Island, Moline, Illinois.
Okay.
So kind of like the central part of Iowa, but on its east coast.
I have been in Davenport. I didn't know I was in the Quad Cities. Okay.
There you go. So let's get to Winona. So we're going to, I would kind of recommend spending a couple nights in Winona. There's some similar things you can do there that we've already talked about with overlooks. And I won't go over all the overlooks again, but you should go to Garvin Heights for sure. One of the things that's kind of interesting about Winona is that for a town of its size, which is, it might be 20,000. I forget exactly its population. It's not a big city, but it's got a couple colleges and it's got a strong manufacturing base. It's got a really good art scene. Okay. Especially for a town of its size. So there's the Minnesota Marine Art Museum is definitely worth a stop. And it's got a collection of water-themed art. Some of it is related to the Mississippi, some of it other waters, bodies of water around the country or the world. But that's definitely a place that should be high on your list to visit. And if you're there in the summertime, they have a Shakespeare festival that runs much of the summer. That's a pretty big deal. They get actors from around the country who come for, I think, 6 weeks from late June until early August to put on Shakespearean shows.
Hmm, okay.
Who would have thought, huh?
I did not know. I keep getting surprised by different Shakespeare festivals. And I'm a Shakespeare fan, so pleasantly surprised.
There you go. So you got to put that on your bucket list of Shakespearean experiences now.
I think Stratford might be a little higher on that list for me for right now, but okay.
Somewhere on that list, maybe 15 or 10 or somewhere in that range, but still, it's worth going to. Winona also has a nice collection of architecture. So one of the patterns in the way a lot of these river towns developed is they had very clear boom periods when money was flowing in and sure. People were doing very well. And you get some really beautiful buildings from those eras. And Winona has had a fairly lengthy boom period of its own into the early part of the 20th century, for sure. So there's some really interesting architecture there. There's a bank, the Winona National Bank, that's built in the style that I've seen described as Egyptian Revival.
Okay.
Which is not a style you see in many places.
No.
But you can kind of picture what that might look like. It's not a pyramid. It's definitely got more than a hint of deference to Egyptian architecture.
Okay.
The founder of the bank was also an avid big game hunter. So upstairs, there's a collection of taxidermy of animals he hunted. And
okay.
So that's a bonus. If the Egyptian revival architecture is not enough on its own, then there's always the taxidermy collection to tour.
Okay.
I don't know if you're familiar with the Watkins Company that produces a lot of mixes, your food mixes and herbs and some herbal remedies.
I am not.
They're a pretty big deal. Maybe they're a Midwest thing. I'm not sure how far their reach is, but they have their headquarters in Winona, and their headquarters building is gorgeous. They spent over $1 million on it early in the 1900s. So it's got incredible stained glass and Italian marble, and it's open to the public. So it's worth a stop in there to check out its architecture. And for something completely different, just a little south of town, there's a historic home called the Bunnell House that I think might be the oldest existing family residence in the state. It's built in the 1850s. Another catchy architectural phrase, I've seen it described as steamboat Gothic.
Okay.
So we have a couple of unique architectural styles here in Winona, so that's reason enough to stop. One of the fun experiences locally, a lot of folks like to go to the Lakeview Inn, which is a traditional drive-up burger joint, basically. Dates to the 1930s. It's one of the oldest continually operating restaurants in the state. And if you happen to be there in the middle of the week, Wednesday is classic car night. So you'll see people in their 57 Chevys and other classic cars lined up out front to show them off.
Okay.
Also, the Boathouse Restaurant is a nice place down on the riverfront. It's fairly new, a couple years old, and they do a lot of food based on seasonal ingredients and trying to source as much as they can locally. And I can vouch for the fact that they have a really delicious walleye plate also.
Okay.
Walleye is pretty common.
I could believe that. Now, is it like Wisconsin where everybody does a fish fry on Friday?
There are a lot of fish fries on Friday nights, yeah.
Okay.
And some places every night is a Friday night when it comes to the fish fries. So.
Okay, good to know.
Winona's got kind of the standard range of accommodations, but they also have a handful of bed and breakfasts. So the Alexander Mansion B&B is a 19th century Victorian mansion that's in really good shape. And if you're into the B&B experience, I would recommend staying there.
Okay.
So we're going to head on down to La Crosse, which is on the other side of the river now, but we're going to drive down the Minnesota side and cross over when we get to La Crosse. And along the way, like, there are a couple of additional stops you can make if you want. There's an 1860s era stone grist mill called the Pickwick Mill. That's worth a visit if it's open. Their hours are usually limited to weekends, and sometimes not even then. I think they sometimes have trouble finding volunteers to get it open, but it's worth driving by there and seeing if they're open if you're in the area. It's a beautiful, like, six-story stone mill in a scenic tributary, or along a scenic tributary of the Mississippi. The Apple Blossom Scenic Drive is a route that connects the small towns of Dakota, Minnesota to La Crescent, Minnesota.
Okay.
You could probably drive that in about half an hour. And really, the highlights for me, there are some places you can pull over for pretty views. But if you can get there in the spring, like late April, early May, when the apple trees are blooming, it's really pretty that time of year.
Okay.
There are lots of apple orchards, so if you can't be there at that time, you can come back in the fall when the apples are being harvested, and you can buy Honeycrisp apples and other varieties that are grown right in that area.
Okay.
And then we'll go on into La Crosse, and this is a place that's close to my heart. I lived there for 6 years. I got my undergrad degree there, and then I stuck around for a year after I finished college because I liked it so much. I really think, like, the highlights in La Crosse are going to be more of the outdoorsy stuff.
Okay.
I'm going to, like, highlight, like, three different kinds of activities that, and I'll give a recommendation for each. Like, if there are lots of places to hike in the immediate area, but within the town itself, the Hickson Forest has something like 13 or 14 miles of hiking trails. Some of them also double as dirt biking trails, and they start at floodplain level and go all the way to the tops of the bluffs. In these cases, we're talking a 400 to 500 foot elevation increase. So you can get a good workout hiking through those trails and finding the overlooks. On weekends, it can be a little busy, but you can still find areas where you're not going to be running into a lot of people. So it's a great place to go for a hike and get away if you don't really want to drive too far into the woods. One of the iconic bluffs in the city is called Granddad Bluff. There's a park on top of it. It's very prominent. It's right at the end of Main Street. And there are a couple of places where you can walk to the end of the bluff and overlook the entire city and river valley. So that's an easy one. You can just drive to the top of that and then walk a short distance to the overlook itself. There are lots of bike trails in the region. There are two in particular that offer really good rides. One of them is the Great River State Trail that starts just a little bit north of La Crosse in a town called Onalaska, and it goes 24 miles, and most of that's flat. So it's an easy ride, and it's great territory if you like to canoe or kayak, or I guess stand-up paddleboarding is big now, so we don't want to leave them out. You can canoe on some of the smaller rivers, like the La Crosse River is an easy paddle. There are places you can paddle on the Mississippi itself, and Goose Island County Park has a signed water trail through the backwaters of the Mississippi, which are really scenic, and again, it's a place where you're liable to see a lot of wildlife while you're out there. So you could easily kill a couple of days just taking some long hikes, spending some time paddling, and then if you have a bike, you can go for a little bike ride as well. It's a very outdoor-friendly environment.
Okay.
So other than that, the city does have other things to see, and I encourage you to spend some time getting to know it. As the Hickson House is a 19th-century mansion that was built by a lumber baron. One of the things that sets it apart from the standard historic home tours is one of the rooms was done in a Turkish style. It's a Turkish sitting room.
Hmm.
So that's a little unusual. There's an old chapel at St. Rose Convent, the Maria Angelorum Chapel. That's really a beautiful piece of architecture. I've been there, I think, two or three times. I don't know how much of a fan you are of church architecture. I can't get enough for the most part. So there are places on this tour where you can visit some beautiful churches and chapels, and this is one that should be high on the list if you're interested in that.
I think it'd be safe to say that I am more of a fan than my wife or my son, based on our travels.
So there's some compromise there. You don't get to see all the churches that you want to see, and they get to see some that...
That is correct.
Well, then take them to this one. It's a quick tour. It's not like they're going to get stuck on a two-hour tour wandering around a big church somewhere. It's just a quiet, peaceful place, and it's the home monastery for the Sisters of Perpetual Adoration, who've been praying 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for about 150-some years.
Huh.
It's interesting just to kind of hear their story. if you're feeling overwhelmed with the seriousness of life or whatever, then you can head back to the just south of downtown and you can visit the world's largest six-pack.
Okay.
It will not fit in your carry-on, so don't try to do that. But yeah, it's just a couple of big silos painted with beer can labels on them. Do you remember old-style beer?
I do not remember old-style beer.
I'm not sure how good their penetration was on the West Coast or other places. They were huge in Chicago. At one time, they were the top-selling beer in Chicago. They were brewed by the G. Heilman Brewing Company that was based in La Crosse until they were bought out in the late 1980s. And that brand is, I guess, kind of still around, but I don't know who's brewing it anymore. So there's a big brewery in La Crosse that was once the G. Heilman Complex. I don't think they're doing tours as regularly as they used to. But if it's worth checking to see if they are, because you could tour the old brew house, which is really a beautiful architecture and worth seeing if it's an option.
It looks like there is a tour every evening.
Well, that could be the Pearl Street Brewery.
That is
also
the Pearl Street Brewery, yes.
So that's a smaller place. It's a craft brewery that's been around probably at least 10 years. They make really good beer. It would be worth doing that, but they're a small operation compared to the giants. I do want to mention a couple of festivals. Well, before we do that, I'm going to mention one other place. So I love these small museums also. I've been to the British Museum and some of the world's big museums, but I really love these small town museums because oftentimes you have a few people that are really passionate about something who are showing off what they like, their collection or some aspect of their town's history. On the UW La Crosse campus, there's a building that houses the Mississippi Valley Archaeology Center. And this is a group that's been doing archaeological digs and research in the area for 30 or 40 years now, I think, if not a little longer. So they have a collection of artifacts that tell some of the stories of the people who lived in that area before Europeans arrived. And that's a place I think that's well worth a visit as well to kind of understand more about who was there before we started moving in.
Okay.
There's a lot else here. I'll just highlight a couple of other quick things. Like, you're going to need to eat at some point. So like Fazy's, F-A-Y-Z-E, is a popular breakfast place. I love going there for affordable breakfast when I need to overeat, especially their big plates. The Waterfront Restaurant is one of my favorite places to eat anywhere along the Mississippi. It's right on the river. If the weather's nice, try to grab a spot on the patio. They have a seasonal menu. Everything they do is delicious. I really love that place. If you can't get in there, maybe you can get in a place called Love Child, which also is doing some really creative menus and using seasonal and local ingredients for the most part. But they have kind of I don't quite know how to describe their decor, but it's kind of like a retro modern, something in that vein.
Okay.
Both of those, the Waterfront and the Love Child, easy places you could have a leisurely dinner and sit there for 2 or 3 hours and enjoy yourself with a couple glasses of wine. So La Crosse, I don't know if this is an actual record in the Guinness record book. When I went to La Crosse to start college, I had heard that it was in the Guinness Book of Records for having the most bars on a single street. Something to be proud of, obviously. It still has some really interesting places just to grab a couple of drinks. And one of them, I love going to a place called the Starlight Lounge. It kind of reminds me of stepping into a Jetsons set, if you remember the Jetsons cartoon.
Yep.
It's kind of decorated in that style. It's very much like this relic of the past. Drinks are affordable. They have live music, usually jazz on weekends. It's a great place just to hang out and enjoy the scene and people watch. And then the Bodega Brew Pub, also downtown, has some ridiculous number of beers on tap, like 80 or some crazy number. But it's been a bar and restaurant going back to the late 1800s. So it's another historic spot. It's a very popular place to hang out and have a couple of beers. They tend to feature more local and regional stuff, but they do have craft beer from around the country also. And then the Turtle Stack Brewery is another little craft brewery that's been around for about 3 years now, I think. And they make some really good beer as well.
And then I think that was the end of your arc. Am I correct?
Yep, that's the end of that southern part. Then we're going to start working our way back north.
Okay. And well, let's pause here for a second, because we're running out of time rapidly. One thing I'd like to say is we, you know, Dean and I debated the show a little bit. He obviously in favor of it and me a little unconvinced. This is obviously not the kind of show where you're seeing the new seven wonders of the modern world or the best national parks in the U.S. or things like this. So it seems like, one, this is a regional trip for people in the area, but it also seems like, and stop me if I'm wrong, that the person who should do this trip is someone who wants to see and reconnect with kind of small-town America.
Yes.
This person who liked that Route 66 show and said, where should I go next? I see this as the world's largest six-pack as being analogous to the people who liked that show. Am I off base?
I think you're right on. I listened to that show as well. And yeah, I think it's pretty much in vain with that.
Although the difference is I think you got more hiking and kayaking because we're on a beautiful stretch of water the whole way.
Right. There's not much kayaking in Arizona.
Not as much. It is slow.
Yeah. But I think you're right. I mean, I think this is the kind of trip where you get to spend some time in smaller towns. It's an opportunity, I think, to get more acquainted with the middle part of the country if you're not familiar with the Midwest. Mm-hmm. There are plenty of places you can stop in and visit with people, chat. I just kind of feel like our country is at a point now where it's not a bad thing for us to slow down and spend more time talking to each other. And a trip like this is a great opportunity to do that.
Well, and, you know, if we had to measure this trip versus the Route 66 by the odometer, you would definitely lose. But that's not, I don't believe that's what you're trying to do. You're not trying to see how far you can get in a week, but doing a little different pace that includes the hiking and the kayaking and things like that as well.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, let's go finish up the other spots here again. We're heading into record territory for length here. So where else are we doing on the way back?
Well, I'll just go through these a little faster then. So, because there's some similar experiences again with more places to hike and some interesting places to stay and eat. But we're going to continue on north from La Crosse and we're going to drive up to Fountain City, Wisconsin, which is where we're going to overnight. And along the way, we're going to make a couple of stops. I like this park. It's the Van Loon Wildlife Area is a floodplain forest along the Black River, which is a tributary of the Mississippi. But at one time, there were roadways that ran through this area. So there's, I think, 600 or 700-year-old bowstring bridges, these little arched bridges that crisscross through this area. So you get a little bit of a sense of the history of the area with these old bridges. Plus, you have floodplain forests, so there's a lot of birds. It's a good place for bird watching, and it's a beautiful hike in the fall. And it's flat, so it's an easy walk.
Okay.
And from there, we're going to head on up to Perot State Park, which is another one of the jewels in the park system along the Mississippi. Great hiking, overlooks. You can canoe in the backwaters there. If you've got a couple of hours, it's worth stopping there. Fountain City itself is a pretty small town. I think it's under 1,000 people, but it's an old river town that's tucked in this really narrow, flat ledge below the bluff. So the town is long and narrow.
Okay.
And in this area, we've got a few things to check out. One of those fanatical collectors, there's a place called Elmer's Auto and Toy Museum on top of the bluff that this guy has been collecting antique cars and toys for his whole life. And he's got barns and sheds full of these. And it's worth a couple of hours just to wander through that. And in town, there's one of those semi-goofy attractions called The Rock in the House.
Okay, I think I've heard of this actually.
Yeah, it's not as tragic as it could have been. A rock came tumbling down the bluff into this house, and nobody was hurt. But this happened 20 years ago, and they decided to turn this into a little attraction rather than trying to fix it up and live it again. So you can stop and visit this house, which is feels a little creepy at first because the door is not locked. You just walk in and there's an old radio playing and you feel like there ought to be somebody there. It kind of feels like you're walking in on somebody's private home. And then you open one of the bedroom doors and there's this giant rock in the bedroom. It's worth 10 or 15 minute stop for that. It's not every place you get to see a rock in a house.
You know, and I was confusing it, and this is going to sound funny, with the house on the rock in Wisconsin.
Exactly. I think that's an intentional play on that. Yeah. The house on the rock is a very different experience, but worth it in its own right.
Okay.
So one of the other interesting experiences on this part of the river, too, is there are pizza farms.
This is where they grow pizza. I did not know that.
Pizza. This is where pizza comes from, right?
Well, you should have led with that, Dean.
It's the most important. You're right. I buried the lead. There are three of these places that are basically functioning farms that one night a week or maybe two nights a week, they serve wood-fired pizza using ingredients that come entirely from that farm or almost entirely.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So very local lore.
Yes. Near Fountain City, there's a place called Suncrest Gardens. That would be the one to check out because most of them are during the week. This one has some weekend hours now, and it's very informal. It's mostly locals, I think, that'll be there. People bring a blanket. They get their pizzas. They might bring a six-pack in, and they just kind of sit out on the farm and enjoy their pizzas. It can take an hour or more sometimes for your pizza to be ready, depending upon how busy they are. But it's another one of those opportunities to just hang out and talk with people.
Excellent. I thought you were going to try and pull something over on me, like when the BBC did something on April 1st about the spaghetti harvest in Italy. But you can Google that on YouTube, I'm sure. But okay, no, that sounds very interesting.
Great experiences. Fountain City also has a very old bar called the Monarch Public House. It's kind of got an Irish bar theme. So if you still got some time to kill in the evening, pop in there to the Monarch Public House and you can enjoy a beer and conversation there. And as far as lodging goes, like I like the Hawksview cottages. They're kind of built into the side of the bluffs. It feels a little bit like luxury tree houses, although they're not actually in the trees. It just feels like that. But those would be a good place to stay.
Okay.
And then we've got to get ourselves back up toward the Twin Cities. So as we're heading back to catch our plane or a train, there are a couple of stops that we should probably make on the way. This is where it got kind of hard to make choices about how to spend your time, because on this side, now we're getting back to the Lake Pepin area again.
Right.
And on the Wisconsin side, there are some really beautiful small towns that have great food, interesting places to stay, plenty of hiking, all the usual stuff. One of these, it's just before you get to Lake Pepin, is the town of Alma.
Okay.
Probably the thing you should do there, if you're running out of time, you should go to the Castle Rock Museum, which is another one of these avid collectors who decided to build a museum in his hometown. So a retired judge who collected medieval arms and weapons.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah. So he built a whole museum to house his collection of stuff. Not the kind of thing you would expect in a little town in Wisconsin, but worth the stop.
Hmm.
And then from there, you're going to have these beautiful towns, Pepin, Stockholm, Maiden Rock, Bay City. Stockholm, Wisconsin is known as kind of an artist colony. There are lots of little shops there selling various kinds of artwork. It's worth stopping and roaming around there. Maiden Rock Bluff is one of the famous landmarks along the river. I think Mark Twain even wrote about it in Life on the Mississippi. You can drive most of the way to the top of that and walk 15 minutes to the edge where you have expansive views looking out over Lake Pepin. And just down the road from there, there's a place, the Maiden Rock Winery and Cidery. It's the only place I know of in the area that's making traditional hard ciders.
Okay.
From apples that they're growing on site. And in Stockholm, there's also a place you need to stop for pie. Of course, the Stockholm Pie Company, so that's easy to spot. Pepin, Wisconsin is known as the birthplace of Laura Ingalls Wilder, so there's a museum and a replica of the cabin where she was born, and some good food and some wineries around there. You could stretch this out a couple more days easily if you've got more time and visit some more of these places. You could make a tour just sampling wine from all the different local wineries, and there are probably a dozen or more of those.
Is there a type of wine that they tend to offer that is popular in this area?
There are some grapes that are specific to Minnesota. The University of Minnesota has an active agricultural program trying to adapt different kinds of fruit to the harsher Minnesota climate.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
They have a few grapes that have been modified for that climate, and you'll see some of those grapes at these wineries. Off the top of my head, I'm blanking on what they are.
That is okay.
Yeah.
In the Finger Lakes episode, we talked about how they were using grapes from some of the colder regions of Europe, like grapes from Georgia or Moldova or whatever. I suspect that they're probably doing similar things here, and it's not varieties that we're as familiar with.
Right. And some of them tend to be a little sweeter, fruitier wines because those are easier to grow. If you're used to the wines from Napa or Sonoma Valley, you may be disappointed. So you can't use that standard.
I am and I do.
Fair enough. I do as well.
Excellent. And is there any place else we want to get to before we get back to St. Paul?
I think at that point, you're going to be hightailing it back to catch your flight or your train home. So if you had time to stop in Prescott, Wisconsin, which you would pass through on the way back, it's got a pretty marina area and some paved trails along the river. You can go for a walk. Prescott is at the confluence of the St. Croix and Mississippi rivers, so it's got a lot of water and there are a lot of boats around there.
And you mentioned boats. My understanding is there might even be some opportunities to do the region we have just talked about, not by road, but by boat.
You could. There are places you can rent houseboats.
Uh-huh.
And you could do a houseboat tour down the river. And most of these communities have public marinas, so
okay.
Or at least some public docks where you could pull over for a few hours. Most people, when they do the houseboat tours, they'll pick an island and they'll attach themselves to an island for the night and pull up to the sandbar.
Okay. So you picked this region when I said, okay, what's the best one-week itinerary on the Mississippi River? I'm going to ask you to narrow it down further to the prettiest spot on this part of the river.
Oof, man, that's like picking your favorite child.
Absolutely, yes.
I'm really partial to Maiden Rock Bluff.
Okay. They're on Lake Pepin.
Yep.
Okay. One thing that makes you laugh and say only in Minnesota or only on the Mississippi?
I would say like probably the regular conversations about mosquitoes.
Okay. That would be the argument against doing the trip in the summer, I would say.
Well, I'm one of those people that I'm not deterred by things like mosquitoes and cold weather. But there's plenty of discussion around the table around how active the mosquitoes are at a particular time of year or a particular time of day.
Right.
So,
what size livestock they can carry off, that sort of thing.
Right. How many children disappeared that week.
That's right. Yeah, we don't have those where I am. Okay.
Fair enough. Lucky you.
If I had to narrow you down to the best post about this region that you've got on the MississippiValleyTraveler.com, what post are we going to send people to?
I think I'm going to send them to I did a post a few years ago, which I'm about to update, Best Riverside Dining.
Okay.
So it's a list of a couple dozen places along the entire upper Mississippi from northern Minnesota to St. Louis, basically, of places to eat with good views of the river.
Excellent. We'll put a link to that in the show notes so that people can check that out. Our guest again has been Dean Klinkenberg, and again, a big fan of the Mississippi River. And Dean, I thank you for coming on Amateur Traveler and sharing with us that love for the river.
Well, thanks for inviting me on. I hope people will come out and see this part of the country.
Way back in February, I heard from Katie, who said, "Hi, Chris, I'm a longtime listener to the podcast from England, and it puts a smile on my face during these cold winter months. The show has inspired me to take my first solo holiday this summer at age of 23. Will there be any upcoming shows regarding the Greek islands? I'll be heading to some of them during the summer, and I cannot wait to relax in the sun and try out my new bikinis. I just wanted to say thank you for a great podcast. Keep up the good work, Katie." And Katie wrote this on February 11th, and a new show came out later that week. Of course, she would have no way of knowing that that was the way. So apparently, if you're looking for a show on a particular destination, you just have to ask. With that, we're going to end this episode of The Amateur Traveler. If you have any questions, send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com, or better yet, leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com. Subscribe to this podcast at Apple Podcasts or wherever fine podcasts are found. And thanks so much for listening. I got to see one more cathedral.